Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, mapping parts of Canyon de Chelly in an effort to preserve its history and why you shouldn't leave your seat during a performance of a puppet show for adults. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It's not okay to be in this country illegally. And people go hate on me for that. If you're in the country illegally, you should be looking over your shoulder. It's not okay to enter this country illegally. It's a crime.
If you've ever bought a car or been in a negotiation, when one side gives you a completely unserious offer, you often have to walk away until they get serious.
We need to take care of these little ones. It is our obligation. It is the obligation of every member of this elected body. And let's call them to task when they don't do the obvious thing. This is easy. It's a no-brainer.
This has nothing to do with politics. This has to do with people putting it on the line and somebody saying, I want to take that from you because I don't have the guts to do it.
This bill reinforces the dangerous and false narrative that there is an invasion at our border, a narrative that fuels hate, fear, and discrimination.
This legislature will take up legislation that will provide the funding necessary for DD to remain intact. And there will be guardrails placed on that.
And with me to talk about a pair of Trump administration officials visiting the Valley, a potential solution to a budget shortfall in a program for Arizonans with developmental disabilities and more, are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Barrett, lots of immigration talk. It's like we're back in 2010.
Yeah, I'd rather talk about puppet shows for adults, but okay.
Coming up later.
Stay tuned. I want to hear that.
So we started the week with the president's border czar coming to Phoenix and addressing a joint session of the legislature. He said a lot of things, among them making a comparison of deportees to Amazon Prime deliveries.
Well, nothing says, humanely dealing with people like shoving them in a tight box and making the driver go 80 miles an hour to keep on time. No, but seriously, you know, I will say that Trump promised to get the border under control. That was the big thing, two big things, inflation and border. And, you know, he's done a good job. I mean, I think you have to give him credit for reducing that stream of people coming across
that
the border.
That was put in place under the Biden administration. It should have been done earlier, but this was a Biden policy.
Under Biden, they were still streaming in the tens of thousands a day. Now, I mean,
November. So,
right? I have heard literally that some Border Patrol agents actually are bored now because there's not nearly the amount of people coming across. They are not having to do as many chases. And so, you got to give Trump credit for reducing the illegal border crossings to a trickle.
And eliminating due process and sending folks to...
He's got due processes on the roundups, that we can complain about a lot.
Inhumane treatment deserves no credit.
Well, Stacey, what did you make of what Tom Homan had to say? We got a little preview of it just there, but...
Right. It was a blatant headline grab, and it was effective. But the policy that's following that up, including forcing local law enforcement, which just in the Valley is 1,000 officers short to enforce immigration law, is insane. To Barrett's point, if Border Patrol agents are bored, send them to Phoenix. Phoenix PD is short hundreds of officers. There aren't enough officers to patrol our streets, to respond to accidents quickly, to take property crime reports. And now we're going to redirect that effort, that energy, that manpower to this pet project.
Well, I'm not really seeing a lot of the local law enforcement. I don't know if that's occurring as much as just, on the border, the people coming in, that's slow to a trickle. And I think people wanted that, and that's what they are getting with Trump. He's got to keep that up. And, you know, probably as he moves into his round them up phase, that's when you're, you know, that's when you're going to hear a lot of people complaining. You know, we've already seen them arresting and deporting people who should not have been deported. And, you know, I understand the whole, oops, we made a mistake. But then to not correct the mistake, throw up your arms and go, sorry. Or for them, sorry, not sorry. I think that's a problem. And I think Americans don't want that part to happen.
Well, so Barrett, Stacey alluded to the what has been known as the Arizona ICE Act that the legislature approved this week and sent up to the governor that requires local law enforcement to cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
Cooperate.
Right. But so this is sort of a tool that the legislature has used in bills relative to cities for a few years now in terms of threatening their state shared revenue, which is interesting because to Stacey's point, cities are already struggling to have enough money to hire police
officers.
Recruit
and retain. Yep.
And if they lose that, if they lose state shared revenue, like what does that do to police departments?
But all they have to do is cooperate, right? They don't have to go out and, quote, round up people. But for instance, in the jails,
blatantly untrue. Cooperate is follow the direction of the federal government, which could be whatever they decide it's going to be that
for
day.
For the jails, it's just work with ICE to like, okay, this person
that's already
arrested.
Happening. ICE was never removed from Maricopa County Jail. Like that was even under Penn Zone administration.
But this is for all counties now. Some have 287Gs. Only a handful of agencies have 287Gs, which is an official cooperation with ICE.
Yeah.
So now this mandates that everyone has to cooperate, but I don't see a big change in
well, procedures. There's a reason that the local law enforcement unions are not on this bill. This is the definition of cooperate is extraordinarily loose. They don't have the resources to do the jobs these guys applied to do.
Stacey, what will Governor Hobbs do with this bill?
Well, that's a Governor Hobbs question. That's
I know, but I mean, what do you think? You're close to the Hobbs administration. What do you think Governor Hobbs will do with
this bill? So I think Governor Hobbs is going to follow local law enforcement's lead. I mean, she has
and veto the bill.
She's met with plea or fix it. I mean, or fix it. Define what cooperate means. Define who's going to pay for it. Define, not only are
She only has a couple of options. Sign, veto, or let become law.
Or fix.
Well, but
or
she can't.
Fix.
Well, she can't fix.
I mean, in theory, she can work with the legislature and have them start over. But I mean, that's a valid point in terms of, you know, we're talking about what this bill does and who likes it and who doesn't. But it could all be moot, right? Once it gets to the governor, if she vetoes it, it just goes away. Although we know that it's always a possibility, and the Republicans in the legislature have done this before, of just sending it to the ballot. Do you think that's a possibility here, Stacey?
Of course. I mean, it's always a possibility with this legislature that they're going to go right around her and send it. What's interesting, though, is local law enforcement is not in support of this issue. I mean, there's lots of things they just let through the goalpost and see how it shakes out. This is extraordinarily dangerous to let federal organizations based on political whim on each side of the aisle to dictate what the guys who clocked in this morning have to do that day. And cooperate could be send me 20 patrol units to whatever neighborhood this is. And they physically don't have them. It will compromise public safety in other places in Phoenix and really the state.
Barrett, I want to ask you about another Trump administration official coming to town, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., of course, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, talking about some bills, one dealing with requiring that people who are on SNAP, what used to be called food stamps, not allowed to use those benefits to buy soda. That does not have bipartisan support generally. A bill that does have bipartisan support is taking a bunch of ingredients out of school lunches to try to make school food healthier. I think a far cry from what the three of us ate when we were in grade school.
Yeah.
He did not, though, apparently want to talk about the measles outbreak and how it could impact Arizona.
You can have my Coke Zero when you pry it from my cold, dead hands.
You're not in elementary school anymore, though, are you?
Right.
It's not a Billy Madison situation.
Look, there are so many positive things to Maha, and then there are so many negative things. You know, this whole measles outbreak, of course he doesn't want to talk about it because, you know, kids are dying, you know, unvaccinated kids are dying. He sort of came out for the MMR
vaccine,
and, you know, which I have, so whatever. And I turned out perfectly fine. I don't understand this whole negative view that he has held for decades of being against this vaccine. And there's no evidence to show that it leads to autism and all that. But he is incredibly popular here. I mean, he gets crowds. People have glommed onto this movement. Again, there are some positive things. Getting rid of red dye or whatever, you know, some of these very unhealthy things in our food is a really great goal. Getting rid of vaccines, not so much.
Well, Stacey, some of the processed foods provisions are things that Democrats have been talking about for a very long time.
Absolutely. I find the irony here that it was the worst idea Michelle Obama ever had to put vegetables in school lunches. My daughter was in elementary school and Michelle Obama came on the TV. She's probably in fourth grade, maybe. She said, I don't like that lady. Like, why do you? Michelle Obama, she was like, we had green beans. My daughter, like, that was the first time I saw her into. Yeah, it was very funny. But no, I mean,
this I revolt against green beans as well. So.
In this at lunch, who has green beans with lunch? Yeah. But anyway, this is certainly something that the Democrats have been very concerned about is poison in our food supply. And if it wasn't coming from a guy that legitimately had worms in his brain, I think we would be seeing the.
Does that hurt the message, though? Like, the fact that, like, this is coming from someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., while, as you say, Democrats have been on board with this for a long time, does it hurt the cause, the messenger in this case?
Oh, it absolutely hurts the cause. I mean, some of those profiles of him I thought were hilarious going into this last election cycle where he's got pet vultures that attack his wife. I mean, the guy is not quite right.
But I do wish that in the movement, I mean, let's take away RFK Jr., I do wish that Democrats and Republicans would work together because there is common ground on making our food healthier.
And that bill has been bipartisan. I mean,
I do think that this is a place, both locally and nationally, Democrats and Republicans can indeed work together. But yeah, I mean, look, if you're just going to bring up worms and dropping off dead animals in Central Park.
I forgot about that.
She didn't mention the bear.
No, I forgot the bear. There's so much.
What about the dead whale or shark or whatever?
There's a lot.
On his roof? Yeah.
There's a lot.
But I think that's the problem is that people is so tainted. Democrats are so tainted by Robert F. Kennedy, the person, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the person, that it's hard for them to work where they actually do find common ground. I think you sometimes need to get over that personality.
Stacey, let me ask you about the budget, state budget. We don't really have a great sense of where Republican legislative leaders and the governor are on the overall spending plan. We did get some details this week, though, of a proposal from the Republicans in the legislature to close a shortfall within one specific program within the Department of Developmental Disabilities, dealing with allowing parents to get stipends to care for their kids who have severe developmental disabilities. The Republicans are willing to put money into that, but also some other provisions in there dealing with other waivers and restrictions on this particular program. The governor had proposed some guardrails, but like, how closely do those align? Like, is there work to do here to get to a compromise?
So there's certainly work to do to get to a compromise. What the governor asked the legislature for is very simple. Fund it for the rest of this fiscal year. There's 2 months of shortfall in funding. Mm-hmm. Take care of it, and then let's negotiate for the next budget package what some of those guardrails are. The legislature, the Republican legislature, is trying to put that all in one package and cut stipends to parents 50% by middle of next year. And that's assuming the federal government even funds any of this. So there is so much in flux. It's difficult for the governor to make a decision or the legislature to make a decision about next fiscal year's funding before we see what the federal government does. And I think it's short-sighted on the Republicans' part.
You know, this program didn't exist 5 years ago. It only came in during the pandemic, and it's been funded significantly by the federal government. The original problem is that the Hobbs administration never really accounted for, well, the federal government has backed off of its funding, and we're still going to fund it at the same level. And instead of going to the legislature early on to say, this is what I want to do, let's negotiate that, she just kept spending, and now we see the shortfall. I think the Republicans are going to fund it. They, of course, want to put on some guardrails. Some of them are reasonable. One of the things they want to do is, you know, all federal funds must be, you know, go through the legislature, all that stuff. They've been trying to do that since I was in short pants. So that's not new. And, you know, they're going to lose, you know, again, that's been going on forever. But, you know, I think they're going to work something out. But the problem here is that the Hobbs administration never kind of caught this and like, oh, we're going to have a problem coming up real quick.
They most certainly did.
No, they didn't. They didn't tell you.
They didn't tell anybody.
Well, they
absolutely did. Okay, and they talked to the Republicans who let it get to a crisis point so they could pin it on her. And that is not accurate.
The Hobbs didn't do anything.
They don't control spending. They need to go to the legislature.
But they didn't start saying, look, you know what? We're going to have a shortfall in this, and we need to either dial back the funding or make some changes and go to the legislature. And they just did it as a supplemental at the start of session.
Let me ask you this, Barrett. So based on what you said about, for example, federal money going through the legislature, do you see this proposal from the legislative Republicans as what they actually are going to dig in for? Or do you see this sort of as an opening offer and they will maybe give on some things and not give on others?
Democratic governors and Republican governors have given the finger to the legislature every time they've wanted.
On that particular provision?
On provisions that give the legislature more control of federal funding. I assume, and then they go away unhappily complaining. I assume that'll this won't be part of the final agreement. I don't think any of that. I think they do have to keep it. Okay, what are we going to do if the federal funds aren't there? We've got a funding shortfall. We have to deal with it this year, and I think they're going to. But we have to now figure out going forward. Again, 5 years ago, this program didn't even exist.
And I also just want to say that it's not just a federal funding shortfall. It's a larger population using the program than what was originally expected.
Yeah.
Somehow that's perfectly fine for school vouchers. Somehow that's perfectly fine for prison health care. But yet this is the one the Republicans are holding up. I mean, it doesn't make it is so cruel when we're talking about which populations get addressed. More kids can go to Brophy on school vouchers. That's perfectly fine. There's a huge overrun there. There's no Republican in the street screaming about it. But we've got more kids in the DDD program than we originally anticipated. And there's a federal shortfall. And then suddenly the governor has made a mistake. It's so blatantly craptastic.
Barrett, I want to.
I have to go to the dictionary for that one.
Yeah, that is not a word I've heard in a very long time. Barrett, I want to ask you about the so-called Axon bill, which is dividing some Republican lawmakers, specifically those from Scottsdale and those not from Scottsdale. This is one that would supporters say keep Axon in Scottsdale. Critics say it would override the will of the voters who want to be able to vote on the development deal, including apartments in North Scottsdale. This seems like a really interesting, like, municipal situation that has taken on a statewide meaning.
Yeah, but and it involves even, you know, our housing shortage, which I think everybody agrees. And, you know, Scottsdale's sort of snootiness about we don't want any more apartments anywhere in the city. And so there are so many layers. But at the end of the day, this is a $40 or $50 billion company. Arizona does not have many of these types of companies. You can count them on one hand how many of these types of companies the state has. And so I think you've got to get creative and figure out how to keep them here.
Stacey, I mean, this is one of those issues that, like, Democrats are not – it's not every day that Democrats are siding with a company like Axon, right?
Well, I would
Look, hey, look, let me just note. I mean, it got 40 votes in the Senate – or I'm sorry, in the House, this week. It was pretty bipartisan. It was bipartisan opposition and bipartisan support.
Yeah.
Look, Axon has provided a level of police accountability that we didn't have before this, right? Body cams. I wish our surgeons would use them. I wish firefighters and ambulance workers would use them as well. But this so Axon is not an anti-democratic company, right? So what I find really interesting about this is it sets really bad precedent that you can buy land for one use from the state land trust and do whatever you want with it if you just wait a little while. And so, and if you're now in a city between 200 and 500,000 and you've got an international headquarters, well, what if I want to open up a flip-flop manufacturing facility in, you know, where next to your house, right? And I live in Peoria, and which is about to be 200,000 residents. So they're on a policy level, it's a terrible policy. It's a terrible precedent. That said, I'm old enough to remember when McDowell Road in Scottsdale was all trailer parks. So Scottsdale's very strange aversion to apartments also needs to end. 80% of the population lives in apartments at one point or another.
I mean, some of the Scottsdale politicians, leaders, like Mayor Braska, is that we don't want any more apartments, period.
Yeah.
And, you know, these aren't going to be slums. This isn't even, you know, affordable housing, God forbid. This is, you know, really workforce housing.
Well, and the bill sort of sets out who would be living in at least some of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like company employees and other.
Right. Yeah.
I think there's first responders, some other people like that who would be living
in those. There's hospitals right by there for, you know, nurses and people who work at the hospital. I mean, these won't be, you know, shabby, rundown, God forbid, for the undesirable population moving into Scottsdale. These are going to be young professionals probably. And so, you know, obviously there is the local control versus, you know, statewide control. But this is something of so important to keep a huge manufacturer, a huge company inside Arizona. It almost trumps everything else.
The local control issue, Stacey, that Barrett mentioned is another one that a lot of folks have talked about, specifically the representatives from Scottsdale who are like, look, people in Scottsdale collected signatures. They want to have a chance to vote on this. You're now telling them they can't.
That's the rub, right? The local control is extraordinarily important. And looking at the projects that have been bounced from our valley because of local control, by exerting local control, talking about the Coyotes Arena in Tempe, talking about the Trump Tower on Camelback Road.
I'm old enough to remember that
right? So local control has been, you know, the core tenet of our state constitution. It's extraordinarily concerning that's the point of bad policy, bad precedent. It's extraordinarily concerning that we can avert that.
How big of an economic development concern? We have about a minute left, so I'll get each of you for just a few seconds on this. How big of an economic development concern would it be? And Barrett, you alluded to this. Like, do you think Axon legit would leave if this bill did not pass?
Absolutely. They are gone if there isn't a reasonable solution coming in the next couple of months. They are absolutely gone. They've said it is not a hollow. It doesn't appear, I should say. I've not ever talked to them, but it doesn't appear to be a hollow threat. They will move because, you know, I think.
Because they won't be allowed to build.
Yeah. I mean,
if it goes to the voters.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is, you know, they've put a lot of time and effort into this. They've come up with good. And just to say, I mean, this is just NIMBYism kind of on steroids.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. But again, this policy is bad precedent. If we decide we don't want a 27-foot or 27-story tower behind us, we should have control over that. And so I'm concerned about the policy and obviously concerned about how bonkers Scottsdale is about people who live in apartments. What, like, who do you think they are?
Interesting. Mario, I'll have to leave it there. Stacey Pearson, Barrett Marson, thanks to you both. I really
puppets
appreciate
now,
it.
Puppets now? Puppets?
Coming up.
Sweet.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, giant ant puppets take over a not-so-big Phoenix stage. But first, Canyon de Chelly is one of the most impressive places in the Southwest. Its vertical canyon walls tower 1,000 feet high as the Rio de Chelly winds through its ancient walls. And it preserves nearly 5,000 years of indigenous history, from the ancestral Pueblan people who built cliff dwellings to the Navajo who still live there today. But for most modern-day Navajo people, visiting some of the canyon's most sacred sites is taboo. Guests who want to visit the inner depths of the canyon have to go with a Navajo guide. Why? Well, according to our next guest, these sites are essentially graves. Alistair Lee Bitsoy is a Diné journalist who decided to go into some of these sacred sites to report a piece for Smithsonian Magazine about a group of researchers and archaeologists who are working to preserve the history by mapping it for the first time using LIDAR technology. But as he told my co-host Lauren Gilger, he felt conflicted about covering it and visiting these normally off-limits sites. His Diné identity shaped his approach from the start, beginning with what to call the holiest site in the canyon.
In the story, we identify the complex as Tseyakin in part because I am a Diné reporter or journalist. So I chose Tseyakin as the word to describe mummy cave. I felt like reclaiming the term mummy cave was problematic to me. And I felt like, well, I don't know what the other tribal languages are for this site, but at least from the Navajo perspective, it was identified as Tseyakin.
Yeah. So Canyon de Chelly, I think a lot of Arizonans have heard of. Like, people know that this kind of miraculous thing exists. And if you have read about it or gone there or thought about going there, you'll know that, like, one of the things about it is that you have to go with a Navajo guide to see most of the canyon at all. And it's because there are places like this there that are sacred, that are holy, that are kind of off limits to anyone, right?
Going into the canyon, it is to, like, Sayakin or Mummy Cave. It requires four-wheel drive. It's a sandy wash, and there's the sensitivity of the site to visiting it, but also the approach of the researchers and what they are still trying to investigate there or find or mitigate at this sensitive cultural site. And so for me, I guess, having worked in conservation and as a writer in different spaces, particularly when it came to Bears Ears National Monument, I learned right away how energies of a landscape can impact a person, good or bad. And I ran clearances through my parents, my family, and then an elder that I admire and look up to for consultation.
Wow. Yeah.
And of course, I was warned, you got to be careful. And I took their points of view into consideration before I decided to go with the story. But I learned in the process how this kind of a story of history, but also it's a gravesite. And so,
yeah,
like, how do you approach that? But how do you tell the science of the architecture of the site?
What are the cultural beliefs, right? You talked about the way in which you did not approach this reporting lightly. Why is it that for most Navajos and most people from other tribes around that area, this site is off limits? Like, you do not go to these places, right?
But for me, as a Diné person and how I was raised, and again, this is not all for Diné people's perspectives either. It's just the way I was brought up. You be careful at these types of sites. And when I'm around such sites where there's graves, like, I got to carry ash, coal ash, or wood fire ash is a solution to mitigate exposures of the dead. At least that's what I'm taught and I believe or experience so far in this type of reporting.
Right.
That's just one method, I guess, of harm reduction in the Navajo experience of reporting on this type of topic, but also, like, being around such a sensitive area. And there's other protocols. Not every Diné follows these protocols. Some just go up there and climb, you know, like,
sure.
So, like, those were sensitivities or layers that I had to figure out on this journey. And I stood down below the area of the site where we were camped out instead of, like, climbing up to the site. And we talked a lot about firsting, like the idea of firsting things, like, oh, this is our discovery. And, you know, I push back on, like, why don't you just leave the site the way it is and let nature, Mother Earth, take it? But then the photographer ended up saying, well, this is my point of view of, like, it's a treasure. Like, I want my children to know about the sophistication of their builders who made this up, because it's something to marvel at.
Right. So let me ask you about that, because what you're getting at there is so interesting. It's that tension between what these researchers are doing there and your reporting on what they're doing, which is about preservation, which is about, you know, protecting this area from climate change, from erosion, you know, like, making sure that it's there in the future for others to understand and enjoy or appreciate. But there's this kind of taboo involved, right? Like, you wrote that you felt very conflicted coming away from it.
Yeah, I am. And even when I see this piece, I still feel conflicted. I was like, well, I went through that. And so, like, there's a lot of relief to get it out there and published.
So let me ask you about what you did afterward, right? Because you weren't sure of the protocol when you were there reporting it. And you wrote that you visited a Diné, like, medicine man, essentially, afterward, right? A cultural practitioner to try to learn how to heal yourself from this experience so that you wouldn't get sick. He told you would get sick, right?
Yeah. And I knew that, like, the potential exposure to such energies, like, would impact my well-being. And it did. I mean, I also knew that going into the assignment. the editors were understanding. I was like, well, I'm feeling sick from this site. Like, I think I was feeling sick or nauseous from the conflict myself, but also just like, well, I was eating around this site that is basically a graveyard, mm-hmm. and I'm eating food with them, and they're exposing me, is what the healer told me. I just followed the protocols of getting cleansed again from the healer. And of course, he told me, if you keep reporting on such similar topics without actual proper protocol, you're going to continue to harm yourself. Now, I now learned about how to approach it, but also maybe reject similar stories in the future.
Right. So that was what I was going to ask you lastly, Alistair, which is sort of being so conflicted going in and coming out of this, trying to kind of cleanse yourself, heal yourself from it because of these things that you've now witnessed. Like, would you do reporting like this and in the future as a Diné writer? And what does that mean for people from that culture documenting it?
I think that's a hard line to like walk. I don't know. For me, I've grown as a human, and I realized I know where to put up my boundaries and the type of reporting. And of course, I'm fascinated with history, and like, I love history. And I hope this piece does some sort of reclamation, or as they say, rematriation of some of our stories and connections and point of view. Right now, I feel like I'm going to take a break from this kind of reporting.
Yeah.
My spiritual being is, and mental, is very aware of how energies, good or bad, can impact me. Uh-huh. And I guess I'm a more sensitive human being, like not only to the landscape, but to my reporting and storytelling.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Alistair Lee Bitsoy joining us, a Diné journalist who wrote this piece about Canyon de Chelly for Smithsonian Magazine. Alistair, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for letting us in here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Andy Berlin was a food critic in Tucson and Phoenix for more than a decade. Naturally, over the years, she's eaten a lot of Mexican food. She even spent the summer of 2015 taste testing 100 different tacos in Tucson. But recently, Berlin moved to New York and published a list of her top 10 best Mexican restaurants on Long Island. She spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about how she's had to revise her expectations when it comes to Mexican restaurants.
There is great Mexican food in New York, but you have to go out of your way for it. Whereas in Phoenix or in Tucson or pretty much anywhere in Arizona or in the Southwest, pretty much any restaurant has decent Mexican food. There's very few places that I've been to in Arizona that I thought was bad. And obviously there are some restaurants that are just absolutely incredible.
So let's talk now about your New York Mexican food adventure.
Yeah.
How did you go about the challenge of finding good quality Mexican food on Long Island in particular? Like, what was your thought process? Did you just kind of start wandering into places, or were you pre-screening?
Well, so I've been on Long Island for a couple of years, and I did a list of the best tacos a couple of years ago. So I already had a little bit of knowledge about it, but I decided to do best Mexican restaurants this year. And I really wasn't expecting that much, but I realized that in my list that most of the places were higher end because there are all these buzzworthy spots. So then I really dug in to find those hole in the wall mom and pop shops. And, you know, with places like that, these little hole in the wall spots, they're really making food that has to appeal to not only a Mexican American crowd, but also people from Central America, South America, and white people. So the menus can often be a hodgepodge, like it might have pupusas on the menu, you know, because they got to please everyone. But I don't hate a pupusa. I like a pupusa.
Sure,
so that's not that bad.
That's interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, the target audience is different in New York, and that affects the way that the people who are constructing the menus, even if they would have an ancestral claim to a certain kind of authentic cooking, they might not necessarily lean into that because they know they're dealing with a different kind of clientele than a restaurateur here would be.
Yeah. And, you know, out on Long Island, I would say that especially the Long Islanders kind of choose their menu. They want what they want. And that's kind of a problem for restaurateurs. You know, if they want pupusas, you give them pupusas. But, you know, in New York City, and especially in Brooklyn lately, there have been a lot of regional Mexican food spots that have opened just in the past couple of years that are uncompromising in their authenticity, for lack of a better word.
Well, let me ask you about this place that you found on the Hamptons called El Verano.
Yeah, that was interesting.
You said the chef has been called a, quote, taco master of NYC.
Yeah, he's a chef, Julian Medina. He's from Mexico City originally, and he has a string of buzzworthy spots in New York City. And like a lot of New York City chefs, he went out to the Hamptons and opened a very fancy Mexican restaurant called El Verano. I went for lunch and the food was very good. Beautiful, beautiful dining room. But the funniest thing about that place was, I've just been thinking about it a lot, they have tacos on the menu, lobster tacos, because this is Long Island, everyone loves lobster. Right. And the tacos are, it's $35 for two tacos.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so if you do the math, that's $17.50 per taco. It's lobster on top. And honestly, it was really delicious. But I'll let you be the judge of whether that's worth it.
I will let the listeners be the judge. But my reaction to you quoting the price perhaps is a bit of a tell.
I mean, it's the Hamptons, but it just kind of reminds me. There's another restaurant that I wanted to mention in New York City. I haven't been to it, but I've read about it. Called Karima. Everybody is talking about it right now. Mm-hmm. Read an article recently. The chef is from El Paso Juarez region. He has a $98 tasting menu. And the first course is a flour tortilla. So it's $98. And the thing you're supposed to get there is a flour tortilla. And you can get it with like caviar.
Okay.
And they call it the bread course. Uh-huh. And everybody is raving about this. And I think it sounds great, but this is just lets you know how Mexican food is in New York. You know, they're raving about a flour tortilla.
Yeah. Right. Just imagine a flour tortilla.
But honestly, I want to try it. Sounds pretty good.
If I'm hearing you right, there's maybe a higher likelihood that someone from Arizona is going to go into a Mexican place looking for, say, Sonoran-style Mexican food made to a certain standard, whereas a New Yorker might not even have that as a palate. You know, they might just have like a general, just kind of a Tex-Mex awareness and, you know, be served something like a flour tortilla with caviar on it and be like, okay, sure.
I mean, I would rather have the flour tortilla with caviar than have a flour tortilla that passes for a flour tortilla at most of the restaurants in New York. What I mean is there are a few people that are pushing the flour tortilla boundaries, pushing the landscape and making excellent flour tortillas. And if they want to serve caviar, okay, I'm all for it, as long as it's a good flour tortilla, because a bad flour tortilla is an insult, in my opinion.
Well, I remember it being a very eye-opening experience for me as a lover of Mexican food to have mole for the first time.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I had ever tasted this combination of like the sweet and the savory and the slow cooked nature of it. It was just like a total revelation, which I'm sure, I know that's not unique to me. What has been your impression of the mole game in New York? And is mole the kind of thing that you remember people really pining for here or not so much?
Mm. Most Mexican restaurants in New York and Long Island have mole because it's Oaxaca, it's Puebla. Most of the immigrants are in New York are from that area. So most people have mole. To be honest, I have not tasted a mole here that was nearly as good as the moles that I've had in Oaxaca City and also in Tucson. Mm-hmm. One of the best moles that I ever had was in Tubac at Elvira's, which is halfway between Tucson and Nogales on the I-19. Wonderful beautiful restaurant. That's some good mole. But to be honest, I haven't had that quality here.
Okay. Well, good to know that even though you've left us for New York, maybe the mole will occasionally call you home. Andy Berlin is a food critic, currently writing at Newsday in New York, but formerly of the Arizona Daily Star and the Arizona Republic. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really fun. Thank you for inviting me.
When you think about puppet shows, lots of things likely come to mind. But it's probably safe to say that none of those things involve giant ants. But that's exactly what Sean McNamara is offering in his latest show called Atomic Ants. McNamara is owner and artistic director of All Puppet Players. The current show runs through Sunday. He joins me to talk more about this. And Sean, first off, where did the idea for Atomic Ants come from?
Well, I love 1950s black and white sci-fi slash horror movies. They're sort of a new genre that I've discovered within the last 5 years. I've really started to fall in love with them, and it sort of transported me back to this particular movie, Them, 1954 movie, with giant puppet ants. And I used to watch this movie when I would stay at my grandmother's house, and I just sort of became obsessed with the idea that in theater, there are all these large puppets, Little Shop of Horrors, you have King Kong on Broadway, but I'd never seen anything that was sort of so retro and sci-fi and bizarre as giant ants. So it all sort of melded together. It hit me at just the right point, and I started working on the script, and it just sort of took off from there.
And you have all different sizes of ants in this show. Like, what is that like to try to logistically put on a stage?
Well, for our stage, it's not great logistically, only because we're in the old Dial building. We're in the Playhouse on the Park Theater, which is basically at the bottom of a 28-story high rise. It was built for meeting rooms. You know, you would take the third floor and they'd come down and have an HR meeting in there. It's not built for theater and special effects and smoke and giant ants. So the creativity of packing the back of the stage with all of these bizarre creatures and different forms, and it became this puzzle while we were working with it. And it was a puzzle that I don't know if I've necessarily completed until maybe just recently. Hmm. Like, we were still moving things around, endings changing, creatures coming out in different forms, different blocking, different lines. I'm always trying to make a perfect show. So our shows are never the same.
Have you made a perfect show yet?
No. One day, though. One day. I've gotten close. I think I've gotten really close. Okay. I think our Princess Bride show is pretty close. But I love to, because I'm in all the shows because I have a giant ego. So I, so my cast and crew have this unfortunate lifestyle where they have to deal with someone who's constantly changing and fixing and trying to make it better. And what's great about all of them that I work with is they're totally up for that challenge.
I wonder about the challenges of doing that. Like, if you're doing that with human actors, you can, for example, change costumes or change makeup or something like that. The puppets, you can't really do that quite as much, can you? Like, well, the puppets are built and kind of, they are who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's one of the nice things about this show is we've created four Whatnot puppets. And what Whatnot puppets are is a Jim Henson invention where their eyes, their noses, their tongues, basically all their facial features can be removed.
Hmm.
And we can re-add new wigs, new costumes. So we actually have four characters that are actually 12 characters within the show that we can rebuild and sort of swap. And this is the first show we've ever tried to do that on.
So I know for you, the story is sort of the main thing. The puppet's almost like a means to an end, right? To be able to
yeah.
write and put a story together. I'm curious about sort of how your relationship with puppetry and maybe with specific puppets has evolved as you've been doing this longer and longer.
Well, I will say when I first started, puppetry was just a means to write and direct a show and produce it.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought I would be doing this 15 years later, and not at all, especially not for my profession. It was just a way to get on stage and sort of get some stage time, and I thought puppets was a good niche to sell some tickets. And when it became something different, I really had to reset my mind. And one of the first things I did was when we approach a show or when I approach a show, I say the thought behind it must be, it's the puppets that are trying to put on Lost Boys, or it's the puppets that are trying to put on Atomic Ants, or it's the puppets that are trying to put on Princess Bride. And things are going to go wrong because they're puppets and they can't do things correctly. And if I can keep that in that frame of reference, everything that comes before it doesn't need to be perfected.
That seems very much like sort of an homage maybe to The Muppet Show, right? Because that was the whole premise, that Kermit and the gang were like trying to put on this giant stage production.
Listen, if you could point out all the similarities by what I'm stealing from those geniuses, you'd be absolutely correct. But I'm only 20% of the genius that they are. And by genius, I really do use that term loosely. And what I'd like to think, in a very, very small, inconsequential, no ill will meant, I think that we're taking that spirit and we're putting it live on stage in Arizona in a way that no one is expecting. It's these puppets getting together and putting on a show of 80s films. And I really think that's a funny idea.
What is your writing process? Because I know that some movie writers or TV writers, like, they will have a particular actor in mind that they are writing a part for. You're writing for foam characters.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to tell you my writing process, and you're not going to believe it, and no one listening is going to believe it, or they're going to hate me and think it's dumb. But I will stew on an idea. It'll just remain in my head. Maybe I'll write down a few little, you know, lines or little scenes. Like, but all I have to do is, once I know what the ending is, I normally, what my wife calls nesting, she'll start to see Harkins popcorn show up at the house. She'll see a couple Red Bulls start to interpret and, you know, show up in the fridge. She'll see some snacks and she'll go, oh, you're going to write this weekend. And then literally what happens is, Friday after I pick up my daughter from school, I lock myself in my office. And then Sunday I normally come out with a pretty polished, finished script.
You're like reverse engineering a story.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I do it in a 48-hour cave-like you know, no outside noise level. It's a very horrible. I wish I could just every morning get up and write, you know, for an hour or two. I know that's a lot of writers. Like, I get up, I have a cup of coffee, I write in the morning. I can't do it like that. For some reason, I find my creativity is almost always eclipses after 6 o'clock p.m.
Well, and as you reference, like, once you're on stage, once you have the other puppeteers, once you have the puppets, it sounds as though you're kind of adjusting and tweaking. I assume that includes the writing as well.
Absolutely. My cast and crew, and this is best joke goes. So if you've got a pitch, if you've got a joke, you've got a bit, shout it out and we'll work it in. I think every single script that my actors have has got scribbles and black marks and pages ripped out, because we're just constantly transforming it into its perfect form.
I'm curious about the reactions you get from your audiences. Like, what are you looking for on stage? What do you see in the audience?
So when we perform, we're wearing these black masks, and I've been in these masks now for almost 15 years. And what I am scanning for is, I'm not really looking at faces, I'm looking at body language. And what I'm really looking for is people who are getting up and moving, or someone who is whispering to someone, because I'll stop the whole show to talk about that. Hey, where are you headed? Hey, who are you guys talking about? We're right here. This is in TV. I can see you talking. What are you saying?
As the puppet says.
As the puppet. Yeah. There's nothing crazier to me than someone going back home and being like, I was in the middle of a whisper and this puppet turned to me and was like, what the are you saying? I just love that idea. So I'm living in the moment in terms of what I'm looking for is something that will make this show even more a one-time only event for those people in the audience. So I'm looking for that. It's all so different and genuine, and I don't think that there's anything better than having this childlike innocence coming from adults while watching a puppet show.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Sean McNamara, the owner and artistic director of All Puppet Players. Sean, thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Stay in your seats during the show if you don't want the puppets to call you on it. On that note, that is it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.